This is Max Allen Collins. Please stick around and help me solve the incredible mystery of Mr. Media.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to Monty Schultz, whose just published fifth novel, Naughty, is a terrific 1950s noir thriller, easily his most accessible book yet. Stick around and keep your eye on women who live their lives according to the stars. They only lead to bars. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of women named Ida. And I don't mean my Aunt Ida, who talk like this. Bobby, get me my cigs, will you? Hurry up, Bobby, I need my cigs. In the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. The first time I read fiction by Monty Schultz, I think I could be forgiven for wondering if this was going to be the case of the son of a legendary American artist and writer trying to make a career on the old man's reputation. You know, Schultz. But reading this side of Jordan made it clear Monty had a voice and a style that was uniquely his own. It wasn't perfect, but it would have found its way to print and to an audience whether Dad's name was Charles or not. Now, in Naughty, his fifth book since 1990, I think Monty Schultz has truly hit his stride. This crime noir novel, set in the 1950s, was inspired by the real-life story of Iva Kroger and her husband, indicted for the murders of Mildred and Jay Arneson in 1962. It grabs you by the jaw from the beginning and doesn't ease up until the very last page. Now, if you've read anything from the Hard Case Crime imprint, which publishes everything from James M. Cain and Stephen King to Max Allen Collins, I think you'll agree that Naughty would be a perfect fit there. Instead, it comes from Fantagraphics, best known for its graphic novels and cartoonist biographies. The Seattle publisher continues its foray into selective fiction with its fourth Schultz work, and it's a doozy. Oh, and here's something you don't normally get with author interviews. Monty Schultz is going to sing an original song a little later in today's show. Monty Schultz, welcome back to Mr. Media.
Thank you. Really glad to be here.
Delighted to have you again. We always enjoy talking. And we've talked about this, so you know, you already know that I like the book. There's no surprise there. But I figure there's going to be a lot of people who don't know anything about Iva Kroger. And I wondered if, to start, so we can give people a basis here, if you could give a little description of the actual case that inspired Naughty.
Yeah, so Iva Kroger came to California in the 50s, probably from Kentucky, and met an older guy named Ralph Kroger when he was attending to his father in a rest home, I think in San Jose. And then they connected and they fell in love and they moved up to San Francisco and were having a good time out there, although Iva seemed really strange. She was involved in Rosicrucianism and astrology at the time and seemed to have a slippery grasp on the facts of her own life. And then sometime, I believe it was in 1961, she stepped onto a jitney in downtown San Francisco, and some poor guy lost control of his car and smashed into the back of the jitney, knocking her out. And throwing her to the sidewalk, she apparently had some serious injuries. She said all her teeth were broken and, who knows, pelvic injury and a variety of things. And she filed an insurance claim on it using Melvin Belli's office as her lawyers. And then The insurance company, of course, as they're wont to do, sent out investigators to follow her around to see if she's really injured or not. And the Krogers got so upset about it. Ralph was a hog carrier in San Francisco, just a regular workaday guy from Colorado, from a ranching family. They got irritated, so they decided to go 60 miles north to Santa Rosa, Sonoma County, to visit a friend of theirs. I think his name was Jose. I can't remember his last name. Hernandez, whatever. I fictionalized these names. I can't remember what their names really were. But anyhow, suffice it to say, let's just call him Jose Hernandez. And they had a strawberry farm, and I got the idea that she and Ralph ought to get into strawberry farming. But they realized right away, well, they weren't really going to do that. And so meanwhile, they were put up by the Hernandez in a motel, the Rose City Motor Court, next door to the Blue Bonnet Motel. Actually, they stayed at the Blue Bonnet, and they met and Iva Kroger met the Mildred Arneson, who was running the Rose City Motor Court. She was up in Washington State. She'd been investing in real estate. She'd been a nurse and investing in real estate up there, and earned a lot of money. Came down, and her motel was a bust, though. And what she really wanted to do was go to Brazil, where she heard there's great real estate opportunities. And so this woman, who now was calling herself Eva Long, told her that she was a millionaire and she owned apartment buildings down in San Jose and could finance her trip to Brazil. And so Mildred was thrilled, because she wanted to go to Brazil for the opportunities, and two, she was afraid of nuclear war and atomic fallout in the States, so she felt she was going to be safe down in Brazil. So should I give away the case, the story, how much I want to give? Well, I will just say, suffice it to say, Mildred and her husband, Jay, who was a 70-year-old Parkinson patient, former World War I veteran and geologist and newspaper man, in about 6 months after that meeting, both disappeared. And Eva Long, Iva Kroger, was running the motel. Ralph didn't want anything to do with it. He thought the place was a dump, a not fit for hogs. Okay, and he went back to San Francisco. And some peculiar events occurred, which led to the mystery of the disappearance of the Arnesons. And that's essentially the core of the case.
And what was the first you heard of this, the actual case?
Yeah, I was 10 years old. And we lived up in Sonoma County, and I suppose I read about it in the San Francisco Chronicle. I just remember two things. I remember bodies buried in the basement of a house I remember it as being an apartment in San Francisco, buried in the basement. And then the trial of this I thought her name was Eva Kroger, and her banging her shoe on the table like Khrushchev at the UN. And that's the only thing I remember. And then that just stuck with me for some reason. It's hard to explain why. It just seemed kind of creepy, I guess, in some way. And her name was – you know, Eva Kroger was so ominous. And then I guess when Freddy Krueger came, maybe probably reminded me of her and the name, at least. And then I conceived a novel taking place up in Eureka called Ocean City, where the character, I was calling him Joe Kroger. He wasn't Ralph Kroger, but I thought, oh, wow, he's going to meet a girl, young woman at a boarding house, and she's going to be kind of like Eva Kroger. And then they're going to – some stuff is going to happen up there, and then they're going to come down to San Francisco. And then I guess I'll just try to – I'll kind of base it on what happened in that murder. Maybe they'll have bodies buried in a basement or something like that. And then I was explaining it, but I looked up Eva Kroger when the internet came around, and I could never find anything about her. And then I was talking to a friend of mine from Santa Rosa. I mentioned this new book idea, and she said, oh, well, no, her name was Iva Kroger. And our friend Boney Salutis, a newspaper reporter from Santa Rosa's Press Democrat, she said, Boney covered the case.
Oh.
And so I called him up, and he gave me all the newspaper clippings and told me all about it. And suddenly I realized, oh, wow, I can make the whole novel. It fits. My fictional idea merged with the true case was perfect. And so I worked on the book. Oddly enough, I don't know if the book took really more than actual writing time, more than 2 years, but looking at files the other day, I think yesterday, I started writing this book 10 years ago. Yikes. But, you know, I was publishing my 20s novels with Fantagraphics and editing and doing tours, and I would work on the book sort of sporadically. And that's the genesis of this.
And as you were talking about that, I was thinking, so how much – now what was Ralph Kroger like in that Joe Kroger in your book, later Joe Long in the book, yeah. He is he's not a drifter, but he is a guy who just seems to be drifting through life. He's aimless. He doesn't seem very bright. Now, was Ralph anything like Joe?
No, Ralph was. It was funny. They referred to him in the case as in the newspaper as a Gary Cooper type, not a man of few words, taciturn, serious, sympathetic, hardworking. When he got arrested along with Iva for the murders, his friends in the hod carrier union down in San Francisco all came up and testified on his behalf that it was not like him at all. And his brother came out and they said, this is just not Ralph. He just would never do something like that. And the judge ultimately at the end of the case agreed and gave him a sentence far, far less than Iva. But he ended up dying in jail. No, they were similar at all. But again, remember, I didn't conceive the case knowing anything about Ralph Kroeger, anything whatsoever. I'd already made up the whole template for the novel before Boney introduced me to the rest of the case. And then my private eye, I hired a private eye, Lynn Dugan, former Secret Service, was actually on the Secret Service detail that covered the Manson family at the time of the Ford assassination attempt by Squeaky Fromm. And he tells a good story. I got to tell this because it's really funny. Yeah, I'll just sort of paraphrase it. He said they were sitting outside the house, a house in Sacramento where some of the Manson girls were sitting in the car. And he said one of the Manson girls came out and sort of tapped on his window or comes over to the car and says, "I think we're going to kill you tonight." And they just opened their folded their coats to show their weapons and said, "Not tonight, honey. Go back indoors." Okay. Wow. So that sounds pretty creepy. But Lynn traveled all over the country interviewing people about my book and trying to find where Iva went after she got out of prison and all that sort of thing. Back and traced her to Boston, where she apparently died in the year 2000. Talking about that trouble back in California she'd had 20 something years before.
Well, I just loved these two characters of Ida and Joe. Ida, and they're so classic James Caine. I don't know if the real Iva and Ralph were like that, but Ida and Joe in the book are absolutely classic Caine. In that, I mean, I kept thinking of now I've read the Caine books and of course seen the movies. So in the case of Postman, I was actually thinking of Ida, very similar to the remake of The Postman Always Rings Twice, and this woman who was perfectly comfortable using sex for anything, and Joe is this guy who's just kind of witless and drifting through life, aimless, and finds himself caught up in all this stuff. And fascinating. I mean, I just couldn't put the thing down. What I'm wondering, though, is where does reality and fiction mix in the book, and where do they pull apart? Where do you decide to go, okay, this is fact, but now I've got to take it another place? Is it because you don't know what happened, or because it's just more interesting and more fun?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, again, I conceived the entire first part of the book that goes up through the final events in Ocean City. And once I knew more about Iva Kroeger, I was able to make my Ida Kroeger the same person. So in Naughty, Ida Kroeger is Iva Kroeger. All her verbal tics, her background, I have her divorce deposition in there. I have letters and poems she wrote, poems that I think, yeah, I have, let's see, there's a funeral early in the book, and I have sort of the thing she reads at the graveside. And that's from Iva Kroeger, a love poem she gives, a sweet poem called Butter Rose she gives to Joe. That's something Iva wrote. So Ida Kroeger, all throughout the book, is Iva Kroeger. Joe, again, is an invented character I made up, just a young guy. Actually, his background, his World War II experiences on Wakhti Island in New Guinea and Finch Haven, I got from my writing friend Sid Stiebel from Los Angeles. So I was asking him all the time, so what did you do down there? And he told me all these stories. And so everything, all the World War II stories you hear in the book, every single one of them comes from Sid Stiebel in the Army Air Corps, okay, in New Guinea. So they're all the World War II stories are all true, including the plane taking off and blowing up. The character in the plane was not the same, but that happened. They loaded bombs on a plane, watched it take off over the lagoon, and just blew up. immediately, which, of course, they felt pretty bad about. One of the bombs just exploded accidentally. So where does it divide? The truth divides at when it says 3 years later. Once they reach Santa Rosa, it's the true case, right to the end, except for the very end in the epilogue. Again, it figured like this. Everything involving Ida is the true story. The only place it veers off is when it's Joe by himself.
Okay.
His father, his life, his background, all fictional. Again, more like Sid Stiebel than Ralph Kroger. The reason I didn't do the whole book as nonfiction was a very simple one. I thought of it when I started seeing how interesting it was. So there are two reasons. One, I really liked my fictional beginning. I liked the whole stuff of Ocean City and the boarding house and the two people who arrive, Frank and Vera Spagnolini. I really liked them. I liked them so much. There's no way I was going to give that up. But at the same time, my private eye and I could not find out anything about her after she got out of jail. Between the time she gets out of jail and the time she showed up in Florida, I believe in the 80s or early 90s. And then she almost got in trouble with the police down there for threatening the boss of, I think, her nephew, whose friend's child drowned in a pool, and her nephew maybe couldn't get off work, and so she threatened her nephew's boss that she was going to kill him, shows up at his door in the middle of the night. And by the way, she's supposed to be legally blind at this time, but she's wandering around, going from door to door, getting along pretty well. And then the guy knew who that was. And so he calls the cops, and they show up, the patrolmen show up, and she says, "I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know. I'm lost. I'm lost, and I'm looking for my niece, Marion or something like that." I don't know what her story was. And so, if you can take me back to the Holiday Inn, we can clear all this up. So they do. They let her off. Meanwhile, a plainclothes detective shows up, and he knows it's Ida Croghan, except they've already gone, let her off. He drives back to the Holiday Inn to get her, and oh, she's not there, and oh, she was never even staying at the Holiday Inn, and she vanishes. The next time she shows up, she's in Boston in the late 90s and dies there in year 2000.
Wow. She's such an interesting character. I have two questions about her. See, I don't want to talk too much about the end of the book because I don't want to and usually I'll try not to read the end of the book before I speak to an author, but this is actually the second time in a month where I could not resist. I had to get to the end. So I'm going to do my best not to reference the end of the book. But I had two questions about her that were bugging me. So I'm going to ask you. You don't have to answer.
Okay.
But I'm curious. The one is Ida, the character in the book, seems to use sex manipulatively, not necessarily for joy or pleasure, maybe a little of that, but she seems to only use sex manipulatively, particularly when that couple comes to the boarding house. And I wondered, am I misreading that? She seemed to only use it when it was to her advantage or she wanted something.
No, that's not true because okay. If you remember, she had a very good sex life with Joe. They were very much in love. And as in the real case, I think Iva had real love for Ralph. Yes, she ended up stealing his raiding his safe deposit box and selling his bonds and and stealing money from it and everything, but she genuinely loved her. I think she just couldn't help herself in that sense, but she was very loyal. Look, if she were not appealing, she wouldn't have had so many people who liked her a lot. So in the book I have Juanita travels around with her and they're best pals. And likewise, the real person, Juanita's real character, Inez Willits, really liked Iva. She just felt betrayed. Everybody felt betrayed by her. Mm. She used to. We did find out that when she would visit, after she got out of jail, she would visit relatives, and she would steal money from the cookie jar. She would actually steal underwear from the drawers. She just couldn't help herself. And Joe says in the book, and as Ralph said in real life, she was driven by just a mad, crazy desire for money, 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 money. And so if you feel that she manipulated people sexually, fair enough, but that doesn't mean she didn't enjoy the sex. And she definitely was a very amorous person with those she really loved. And she was extremely loyal to Ralph. At the end, in the real trial, She stood up at the end and said, "He has nothing to do with it. Send him home. Send him home. He shouldn't be here. He wasn't there in the basement or any of that." You know, so she didn't bring him down with her. She refused to do so.
All right. So my other question is, and this is from the very beginning of the book. As we meet her, she's up to something mysterious in the basement, which, you know, she has a habit of that as the book goes on. She claims this. The book opens at night in the boarding house. Joe shows up. He needs a place to stay, an emergency, a one-night place to stay. All he wants is a warm place, a roof over his head. And by morning, he's wrapped up in this story of hers that her parents have died. They've gone over a cliff in their car. I'm just curious. Were these actually her parents? Were there any real people that this happened to? Or was this just the beginning of setting up a pattern for her?
Well, are we talking about the fictional Ida Kroeger or the real Ida Kroeger?
Let's talk about the fictional.
Yeah, well, sure. No, those weren't her real parents.
Okay.
What happened. Those were not her real parents.
That's what I thought.
Because, no, but you can tell that by her divorce deposition, right? Yeah, yeah.
And well, but I'm not trying to give too much away, but that was right at the beginning of the book, so not her actual parents.
No, and I had a whole backstory worked up, but when I first wrote the book, that part of the book, the first, the Ocean City part was about 180 pages. It just wasn't working. I cut off some stuff, made it 150. I had her have her half-sister from Kentucky came out, and they had this massive fight over their real parents. Although, yeah, let's see, the idea was that she was adopted back there, and then and the real sister was resented the money she'd stolen or something, and so she came west and tracked her down to these, you know, her new parents in Ocean City, and they have this big confrontation. But then I realized the book still wasn't working, and it's funny because a friend read that scene with Dolores, and she's, "Oh, I love that. Dolores is such a really good character." And at the point I told her about it, I said, "Well, you know," or then a month later I said, "Well, Karen, I got to tell you, Dolores is gone. She's out of the book. The whole side story is out of the book. It didn't work. I just thought the book wasn't working well, so I cut it from 150 down to 82. So a lot of stuff disappeared, and then the book was much better. I had Joe talking to his parents more, and, you know, as more interior monologue and psychological stuff on Joe. And I decided what I did was I reread Psycho. I'd already read the James M. Cain book, so I knew that. Mm-hmm. I knew Cain's work. But I reread Psycho because it was a really minimal book, and I kind of got the idea of streamlining the novel. I still write more densely than Block did, and, you know, more elegantly, I suppose, in lyrics like that. But I liked how he structured the book, and it was very spare and stayed right on the plot line. And when I did that to this book, it just worked a lot better, knowing that I would still have lyrical things and philosophical sides that he doesn't have, but just not an excess of them, like I sort of prefer to write, the kind of stuff I did in my 20s books. It just was not appropriate for this. Those books would not have been – I wouldn't have enjoyed them as much had I written them like this. But each book has its own voice and its own intent.
Well, and that's what I want – that was actually the next thing I want to ask you about. I'm wondering, for you, what's the difference between the writing and the finished product of the three Jazz Age book, the trilogy – and Naughty. I mean, to me, they're very different. Stylistically, I mentioned this to you off the air. I thought that Naughty read so much smoothly and so much. It was such a greater page turner, and I attribute that to the experience. You know, this is your fifth book now. You've written a lot, but I mean, for you, what was the difference in the writing and you know?
Well, okay. First of all, you experienced the 20s books individually, but I didn't write them like that. It's one novel that has three storylines running simultaneously. When you change chapters, you change storylines.
Right.
So this side of Jordan, for example, to create it, I pulled out chapters, let's say 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, and 18, and then saw how they read. The structure of the scenes is kind of interesting in that book. So my professor from UC Santa Barbara told me years ago that if I was going to have these three storylines, and it was going to be a really long book, he says each chapter has to have its own story arc. And that also meant what I call live scenes. So it's, if you recall this book, it's fade in, fade out, fade in. Here in Naughty, and a lot of people write, well, you know, he went downtown and bought dinner with this woman, and then 3 weeks later he was on the road in Chicago, and a month, blah, blah, blah. You can't, I could not do that in the big book is called Crossing Eden, the entire book, the 20s book. It'll be published next year. I couldn't do that because it upsets the structure of the book. This book wouldn't make any sense and it'd be really hard to follow. The structural basis or comparison to my book Crossing Eden is John Dos Passos, USA, where you have multiple storylines occurring simultaneously in different locations. So there's no structural similarity. Crossing Eden has a lot of philosophical and thematic issues that Naughty doesn't. Naughty is about fate, but that's basically it philosophically. Crossing Eden has a lot of things going on. What Naughty did, the reason why you like it, well, first of all, you like the idea that it just zooms along, and I was able to do that. I found it freeing in a way to be able to have time pass without it. Basically, well, okay, all this, virtually every scene or every chapter in Crossing Eden occurs within a day or a day and a half.
Okay.
So I didn't have to do that in Naughty. I'm covering a period now in Naughty, and so Crossing Eden, one last thing, Crossing Eden occurs between the spring, in early spring of 1929, and ends in October. Well, Naughty runs from, it opens in 1956 and ends in 1963. So I was able to stretch time and have time pass, and it was very fluid. And so that gives the impression, that's why you liked, because it zooms along, because I was able to make it more fluid in that sense. The books are just different. I don't really have any preference. I just found it kind of fun and easy to write Naughty just because of the structure.
Okay.
It's kind of funny. I wouldn't say that I wrote better in Naughty. I just wrote differently because bear in mind, if you and I talked about, if I wrote the start of this book 10 years ago, that means I was working on it while I was editing Crossing Eden. And so in fact, the period element, the noir feel, the 50s, all of that came from my experience in writing a 20s book. My ability to evoke the period came directly from from Crossing Eden. I just was able to use 50s references rather than 20s references. So I like that.
Are you writing the actual job of the writing? Are you writing anywhere differently than you did then? Do you feel that you are a better writer today than, let's say, back in 90 when you started on your first book or published your first book?
I don't know. That's a tough question because the first scene in The Big Town was the first scene I wrote in Crossing Eden in 1990. And it's in the book verbatim. I would like to. I always like to think I'm a better writer, but when I look back at the older stuff I wrote in the book, probably not true. In fact, I have the same voice in my writing as I always have. Down by the River, right? My first novel, published in 1990, was, and I wrote. I started writing that, I think, in the early 80s. And well, basically, yeah, I finished in 88, got published in 90. So it took me about 5 years to write, working on off and on while I was reviewing for computer magazines. I was a computer game tester and stuff. That was kind of funny. But I like a lot of – I like – Down by the River is so different from Crossing Eden. Crossing Eden is you know, sort of different from Naughty. I don't really know if I write better. I would say I control what I'm doing better.
Okay.
Don't know. I don't know that I could have written such a tight novel as Naughty in 1990. So let's put it that way.
All right.
Okay. On the other hand, when I was writing Down by the River, I could not have written Crossing Eden. I would say I would have had take out the period stuff of Naughty, and I would have had a better shot writing Naughty in 1985 when I was doing Down by the River than I would have Crossing Eden. Because Crossing Eden is a much more sophisticated book, but Naughty is more story-driven, okay? Right. And the pacing is more similar to Down by the River, I think. Right.
Well, now that I've put you on the spot about your fiction writing, let's change gears entirely. We talked a few days ago, and you told me about another way that you've been applying your writing skills, and that is with music. And I wondered, how did that start? And I think you told me that actually preceded the novel writing.
Sure, yeah. I started writing as a in music. I remember I was in college and I was 20 years old, and I just got really involved with music, and I discovered I could, I remember taking Ruby Tuesday and rewriting the lyrics just to learn to do that, and I did it, maybe, I don't know, a couple songs, and I had a friend, the brother of my first girlfriend, was played guitar and wrote songs, and I came back from college in Minnesota, and I discovered I liked writing, I liked music, and I started teaching myself how to play guitar, and then I took guitar lessons, which were basically, as people say now, my boys say, an epic fail, because I'm not really very good, but then it was writing lyrics to then writing my own music and putting my own lyrics to it. And then Dad saw some of these and saw that I had a lyrical gift and I was good at the, you know, turns of phrases and whatever. And so he then had me read Carl Sandburg and Joan Didion and Thomas Wolfe and John Steinbeck, because I think he wanted me to go into writing literature, you know, literary fiction, and then, well, more poetry, yeah, not fiction than poetry, because he had me read. So, but we still share the same books, favorite books, Sandburg's book and Edgar Lee Masters' A Spoon of Rare Mythology. And but I wrote songs for a couple of years. I used to tell people the last couple of years, oh yeah, I wrote 50 songs when I was 20 years old. I thought, well, it's hyperbole. I couldn't have written 50 songs because I can't even count to 50 songs. But then just like really 2 weeks ago, I hauled out my own notes because of a song I just finished recording called Good Evening America that I wrote in 1973, 40 years ago. And I saw the list of songs and I counted them up. I was wrong. It wasn't 50. It was 54. I wrote 54 songs from when I was 21 to 22 years old. Problem is, again, I wasn't a good guitarist. I couldn't entertain myself and I didn't really sing that well. I still don't sing that well. I still don't play that well. But the other thing is, at the time, I had nobody to play with. My friend, my girlfriend's brother could write his own songs, but he found it hard to learn mine. And so our partnership wasn't really working that well. And then I couldn't find anyone else to play with. He brought me out one night to play music with a couple of guys. You know, strum guitars for 10, 15 minutes, and they all wanted to go out and smoke dope. And I didn't. So I didn't smoke dope or drink or anything. So I was like, well, that's not fun for me. And that was it. That was my experience with playing music with other people. I just went on to doing my own thing. Mm. And but music is what really interests me. I like folk music. I like show music. I like pop music because I like melody. Melody drives me. And then what happened a couple of years ago, I met Rosemary Butler as a vocal coach who sings for Jackson Brown, James Taylor, Bonnie Raitt, Linda Ronstadt. She knows everybody. James. Yeah, I talked to James last week. That sort of thing. And she's really great. And I played a song I had just written. And she hooked me up with all these great musicians in Santa Barbara, the A-list guys. And now I have people to write music for and record. And so that's what I've started to do. And I've met some really great people. And I've sort of found my stride. So in a sense, and because I finished these books, the books I really wanted to write, and I can argue I've gone back to where I started. Also, I'd written a piece of music in 1973 called Schoolhouse, a nine-minute-long song that I had the lyrics for the first maybe 2 minutes of a nine-minute song, and it was going to be too challenging literarily. I could say I didn't write well enough. That's what sent me into poetry and then onto prose and writing my novels and everything. But now I realize it's time for me to finish that song. I started 40 years ago. And two of the songs – I have a record that's going to be done maybe in a couple months, maybe sooner, but it should be sooner. Two of the songs I wrote 40 years ago, and one of them's the recordings of them are very special. They're very unusual, very, very big. One of them called Pyramid of the Sun sounds like – in the jam sounds like Santana, and we have the keyboard player, Chris Rhines, from Santana's band playing it. It's produced by Bill Carruthers, and the other – is a song, my song Good Evening America, produced by David West, who I heard play when I was having a date in 1978 with a girl up in Healdsburg, Northern California, and she lit all the candles and played me this Kate Wolf music and my favorite song. And there was a song called Legend in His Time, and it was co-written by David West, and turns out he's from Santa Barbara, Cache Valley Drifters. And I suddenly got to meet him a year ago, and now he's recorded four of my songs. Super great guy.
Wow.
Well, so it's just been good for me.
I want to make sure we get this in. So you're going to play a song for us today. Called Here for a While. And anything you want people to know? I know you need to reach for your guitar, but is there anything? There's Monty reaching for his guitar. There it is. He's got an actual guitar. You want to hold it up a little bit so people just see what you're playing?
It's an Eastman parlor guitar because I have a bad shoulder. The Martin Dreadnought I can't play anymore because it hurts my shoulder too much.
All right.
This song. Do you want me to tell you about the song?
Yeah, I was just going to say, is there anything you want people to know about the song? So please.
It's okay. So this is a song, by the way, that David West is recording. When I first gave it to him 3 weeks ago, he didn't seem enthusiastic about it. Now he really likes it. It's a love letter. I try to write it with an idiom that's about, so it sounds like maybe 70 years old and written 70 years ago, kind of in rural America. Picture it being played on a front porch, okay, in Appalachia or someplace like that. And it's a love letter a guy's writing to a woman who is no longer with him. Okay, so it's here for a while. I wrote it for my girl.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, playing for the first time, I think, on Skype interview, Monty Schultz, here for a while.
Yeah, bear in mind, I'm looking down lyrics because I have a bad memory for lyrics, and it's hard to sing in the morning. Sorry, people. Okay. Once upon a time, remember, there was only me and you, both of us in love forever with a promise to be true. Hearts entwined create a story whose sweet ending we can't know, till the tale it finds a finish when it's scribbled on the soul. We're only here for a while, borne along like a butterfly on a child. All this life trading favors for a smile. I held my breath that moment you came walking through my door. You were the dream I had sought when I came into this world. Now and then I've been forgetting how the moonlight lit your face when you slept beside the window neath that pretty curtain lace. But some old memories like to fool us into thinking there was more to the flutter of an eyelid or a kiss behind a door. Love is only here for a while. When it comes, there's a glory, lights a fire in our hearts that will be an undying desire. Heaven knows I loved you when you lay down by my side. You were the one in this world I just could not. I could not live without. The years roll along, and old fears linger on. Late in the night, alone, we wander again. I yet be in love. I've kept a portion of that time we had tucked inside a chest, fading pictures, old love letters, dried up flowers and all the rest. Do not consider us a failure for the child we would not have. Everywhere I could not take you, nor those days love made you sad. You were only here for a while, come and gone down the road with that beautiful smile, chasing dreams of your own, mile after mile. No one knows a future written in this world, but you were the love in my heart I will never be without. I know this to be true, closing these eyes at the end of my days. I'll be dreaming of you.
Yeah. Very nice. Wow. That was beautiful.
Thank you. And that song took me a month to write. I made up the verse melody in April and then took 4 months trying to figure out another melody for it. I made up the other parts and I made them all up separately and then put them together musically. And they're interesting. The song is interesting because the lyrical cadence for all five parts is different. And then I decided to have this idiom to try to write it in. So what is it going to sound like? Well, it had to sound like, you know, like rural America on the front porch with the moonshine jug and everything. The guy lamenting about his girlfriend. That's how we're going to record, by the way. David's going to have dobro and fiddle and banjo and all this stuff on. It's going to sound really pretty.
And moonshine.
Yeah, it should be moonshine. And then the lyrics. I made up the last line first. Closing these eyes at the end of my days, I'll be dreaming of you. And then I knew the choruses were all going to start with, it was going to be, we are only here for a while, love is only here for a while, you were only here for a while. And I'm just going to have to rhyme those, which is going to be really difficult. And it just had some tricky things. It was really, seriously, it took a month to write those lyrics. And I was working every day. It's just really hard. It's, for some reason, really hard to do. Anyway, thank you.
No, sure. It was great. It was a nice surprise. I think, let me see if I get it right. The next thing people will see from you after Naughty will likely be the release of a song or two.
The whole record. It's going to be called, Mission Canyon Band. It's going to be the Mission Canyon Band. My CD is going to be called After Many a Summer, right? Because the song span on this is 40 years. But it has some really great musicians on it. And, so for anyone who wants to know, I'm actually not singing on it.
Oh,
okay. I kicked myself off all these songs because everybody who sings them sounds so much better. I know, and it's kind of funny. Everyone's, oh, you got to sing on it. No, I actually don't. And it's not like I haven't tried. I've done the scratch track on three of them. Look, I might sing on one song. There's one left that I may sing on. Doubtful, but it's possible. Okay, I mean, I'm not the only one singing on it, so it's possible it's okay. It's just that the other people on the record are so good, and they're rendering. It's not like for example, Lynn Coulter from New Orleans is going to sing this song, and we're going to make two versions of another with a woman named Sean Tease, who sounds like Judy Collins. She has a fabulously beautiful voice, and she sent me a voice memo of the song. I'll shoot it to you, Bob.
Okay.
And you'll see. So you'll see when I send it to you, you'll go, oh, I'm sure you're going to say, Monty, yeah, it's probably better that Sean's.
I would never say that. Maybe I'll think it, but I would never say that to you. So after that, though, sometime in 2014, Crossing Eden will come out, which will combine all three of the jazz novels in the way that you actually envision them being offered.
Sure, and it has a prologue and an epilogue. The epilogue is really beautiful. It's called A Republic of Dreams, and I wrote it. I didn't think I could write it until my dad died, and then he died, and I wrote it. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of his life and our life, and in the last paragraph of the book, how do you sum up a 1,000-page novel in 10 years' work? Because that Crossing Eden took me 10 years to write. My entire 40s, literally from age 40 till I just was turning 50, were spent on that book and given away to that book. And then it took me 6 years to sell it until Gary bought it. And I don't know if it'd be on 2014. It might be 2015. Here's the thing. It's always up to them, right?
Right.
They'll tell me.
Of course.
Because they're trying to make a lot of room for Naughty. And for good guys like you who really like the book and push it, it might have such a life that they – and I haven't even put the book back together. They sent me all the files because, remember, I wrote it in Word or assembled it in Word. Actually, I wrote it in AppleWorks and then assembled it in Word. And I'm not even sure there is a Word version of it anymore because it's been apart for so long. It's been apart since 2002, okay, 2003. So it gets put into PDF files and Adobe and whatever, and I said I have to have the Word files to put the thing back together, and they sent them to me, but they just look odd. They don't look like Word files. So I had all these other things to do, right? I had to finish the Big Town editing and whatever. Then I had to do all this Naughty stuff, and So I really haven't – I've been worried about looking at the files, how to even put the book back. The other thing I have to do is look at the big printed manuscript and see in which – to confirm in which order these things appear. The other thing that's interesting, though, about Crossing Eden is it has four-page vignettes in it whose first-person voice is essentially that of my dad. So those – three of those four vignettes are all dad, his experience in Needles, California, when – in the 20s.
Needles. That's a familiar word around your dad. So folks, you can find Monty Schultz's fifth, and I think his best novel, Naughty. It's in great stores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price right here at MrMedia.com. If you're watching this on MrMedia.com, just underneath the video, you should see the image of the Naughty cover, and it's a naughty-looking cover, I might add. Click on that. You can order it immediately. You can have it, you know, very quickly. Through Amazon. And Monty, I don't know. Do you have a website? Are you an online guy? Facebook,
yeah,
Twitter?
Yeah, MontySchultz.com. Wait, let me put these pictures up, by the way, too. We forgot about
that. Oh, yeah, we forgot. This is Iva. This is the actual Iva Kroger.
Well, Iva Kroger. And, yeah, she's been sitting next to me the whole interview. I forgot about her, so she'd be mad. And then here's the chest in the final resting place of Mildred Arnesen.
And now if you're seeing this before reading the book, now when you get to this part of the book and you see this chest, you read about this chest, you'll go, oh my God, that was a real thing. I mean, you're really touched by that. It's a real, real thing. Okay. So I know you Twitter, Facebook. Do you do any of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook. And yeah, I think I have a page on Facebook. My girlfriend Nicole set this up for me.
All right.
And my publicist. But yeah, I'm on Facebook. But I'm on regular Facebook anyway. But I do have a page that I have Montschultz. But I'm Montschultz.com. And I've been talking to the web designers. And they have the Naughty stuff up now and some other pictures of the case. And suddenly I got this great idea. Oh, put my music up there too. Oh, yeah, I have a whole page of music. Hey, good idea.
Yeah.
So I talked to them the other night, and they're going to start doing that. So you'll be able to hear some of these songs. I'll start putting them up shortly. As soon as they get that set up, I'll start putting them up so you can hear what I can do.
And, folks, if you've gotten to the end of the interview and you've caught these little references here and there to Monty's dad – and I threw in his first name early in the introduction, but we didn't get into it. If you want to know more about Monty's dad and what his thoughts on his dad, there's a previous interview that Monty did with me where we talk about all that stuff. You can go back and listen to it. There's a link here on the Mr. Media page where you can just search Mr. Media Monty Schultz and it'll come up. I didn't see any reason to go into that again today. We've already been there. Monty's clearly established himself as a writer of his own right. We don't need to go into that. But it's easy to find, so go look for that. Monty, always a pleasure to talk to you. I'm very happy for your success. Enjoy the hell out of the book. Yes. Looking forward to much more. Thank you for joining us today on Mr. Media.
Thank you so much. See ya.
Thank you. You can see and hear almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media Radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest 2-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at stitcher.com/Mr. Media. That's stitcher.com/MR Media. Stitcher Smart Radio. the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJs, the party authority for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJs or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJs.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening.